Last week we walked through an outline. If anybody doesn't have a source page from last week, your extra is here. We walked through an outline of all of the instances in Tanakh where we find Bnei Yisrael bringing a Korban Pesach, and the Korban Pesach functioning in that capacity, not just as a reenactment of an ancient of the Brit, or a reenactment of the symbol of Korban Pesach as it was in Yetziat Mitzrayim, but in fact using the Korban Pesach in its... Oh, okay. One of them is going to master it somewhere, but I don't know why. It doesn't matter. That's the computer. Using the Korban Pesach not just as a reenactment of the Brit that the Korban Pesach represented, but in fact, at various points in our time, when we needed to renew the Brit because of the idolatry that had crept into the people because of the circumstances, the Korban Pesach always stood as the center of that reenactment. So Shmuel, after the removal of Avodah Zarah from the land, Yoshiyahu, Chizkiyahu, Ezra upon his return from Bavel, every time there is a reenactment of the Brit, it always is accompanied by Korban Pesach. We saw in Yehoshua that Korban Pesach also is predicated by the ceremony of Bris Milah. And that is where I think we had left off. We sort of identified the fact that there is a connection between Bris Milah and Korban Pesach. We talked about the fact that they are the only two instances of a positive commandment for which inaction carries with it a onish karet, a punishment of karet. They are associated with each other. One is a prerequisite of the other. Kol arel lo yochal bo. Can't participate in the Korban Pesach if there's no Bris Milah, which is a unique halacha, a unique link between two dimensions of Jewish law. And the two critical moments, namely in Mitzrayim, when we enacted the first Korban Pesach, and in Israel as we emerge into the land of Israel, as we enter into the land of Israel 40 years later, and again begin the Korban Pesach, because for the 38 years that they were in the desert, they couldn't bring the Korban Pesach, both of those instances are accompanied by the Brit Milah on a national scale. In Mitzrayim, they circumcised the entire people. That we know from Midrashic sources, although I'll show you from one instance that that's the reason given for the need to take the lamb on the 10th of the month and hold it until the 14th, because they need 3 days for Bris Milah. The Torah explicitly states that you can't bring the Korban Pesach without Bris Milah. For the 38 years that they were in the desert, the Gemara says that they didn't bring the Korban Pesach for all those 38 years, and the Navi tells me that they didn't have Bris Milah for all of those 38 years. So between the combination of the two, there is a fundamental link between these two dimensions, or these two halachot, and in a sense they're both identified as Brit. Milah is certainly Brit Milah, and as we've discussed last week, the Korban Pesach also carries with it an element of a Brit with God, this covenantal relationship as it connects to the abandonment of the letting go of the idolatrous past. That's basically the schematic of what we did last week. Correct? Okay. So a couple of interesting items. Take a look in the Midrashic sources that I've given you. In the Medrash, Bris Milah and Korban Pesach are linked in a number of different ways, in very interesting ways. First is the Mechilta on source number 5. Who is it?
I think it was
Suzanne. Yeah, there's a note on the whiteboard. Okay. Source number 5. This source is the basis for a passage in the Haggadah. It's a Pesach night at the Seder, we make mention of this. I actually didn't quote the Haggadah here, but you'll see the context of it. Vayalachem lemishmeret. Mechilta says on the pasuk that you should take the Pesach, take the offering, and mishchu kulachem on the 10th of the month, take it for you, hold on to it, and set it aside until the 14th. Mipnei ma hikdima ketuv lekichato shel Pesach leshchitato arba ayamim. So Mechilta asks this question: why did they have to take the equipment, the animal, 4 days prior to the slaughtering of the animal? What was the need for those 4 days? The pasuk in Yechezkel says, "Behold, I will come, and I will see you, or I saw." And it was a time of love between the let me explain to you the perek. Perek in Yechezkel Perek Tzayin is a fascinating story. It's actually, this is the perek that we refer to in the Haggadah. It's a parak which describes the relationship between God and Israel through Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Through the metaphor of a baby. The pasuk, the parak describes how Israel is compared to a child abandoned by its parents, cast away in the fields, wallowing and drowning in its own blood. And God comes to this baby, sees it drowning, takes it, washes it off, cares for it, raises this baby to the point of adolescence and childhood, and then enters into a covenantal relationship of marriage with this baby. But the metaphor of the process which takes us from Yitzhak Mitzrayim to Mamar HaSinai into to the Brit. It's that parak which forms the basis for all of the midrashic parables about Israel and God being married to each other, Amar HaSinai being a wedding ceremony, a brit, chuppah. All of those images are based on that parak in Yechezkel. It's a very powerful parak. So the pasuk, so the Gemara, the Medrash describes or interprets the psukim as follows: Higiyesh vuato shenishbar kol shbaruch hu Avraham sheigal et banav. Eight dodim, the time of the dod, the time of the beloved, says the Medrash, is the time to repay the avot, or to fulfill the oath that God had made to the avot, namely that he would redeem Israel. However, v'lo haya biyadam mitzvot she'it asku behem kedei she'igalu, but there were no mitzvot that they had from which they would be worthy of redemption. They were void of any merit over which they, God could hang the redemption and say they deserve it on some level. Shenemar, as it says in the pasuk just before, Shadayim nochonu serech tzimeach ve'at erom ve'eyah. This child had grown to the point where she, her hair was long and her breasts had developed. She is essentially describes the process of reaching a certain adolescent stage. Ve'at erom ve'eyah. But she was naked, and the Gemara understands erom mikom mitzvot, naked of any kind of mitzvot, any kind of merit to which she could be worthy of this redemption. Natan, and that's the pasuk, by the way, that it's this context, these psukim that we quote in the Haggadah. Natan lam HaKadosh Baruch Hu shtei mitzvot. So the Ribono Shel Olam gave Israel two mitzvot by which they would merit the redemption. Namely, Dam Pesach v'Dam Mila. The blood of Mila and the blood of Korban Pesach. Sheitaskubam, engage in them. Kidei sheyigalu, sheneemar, and the psukim are actually in backwards order. Chet, Zayin, Vav. The next quoted is, V'avo alayich v'erech mit boseset b'damayich. I came, I saw you in the fields, drowning in your own blood. V'omar lach, B'damayich chayi, v'omar lach b'damayich chayi. I said, in your blood you shall live, in your blood you shall live. The pshat in the pasuk means that because of the suffering, we merited the redemption out of the suffering, which is symbolized by the blood. The midrashic understanding is that the double reference to the blood is a double reference to the two mitzvot connected to blood that would enable us to be worthy of redemption. That's the pasuk we quoted in the Haggadah. The only other time we quote that pasuk in liturgy, that pasuk is quoted twice at a bris. Correct. It's part of the naming paragraph of the naming at a bris. And that's not an accident. The two times we mention this pasuk, Lel Haseder Pesach, and at a bris. Connects the same issue that we discussed. V'omar gam et gam at b'dam britech shalachti asirayach mibor ein mayim bo. It's a pasuk in Zechariah. Lekach ikdim hakatuv l'kichato shel pesach l'shchitato dalad yamim she'en atin Zechariah ela yidei ma'aseh. Therefore they had to bring the korban pesach forward, or the taking of the korban pesach 4 days earlier, in order to do the bris milah during that period of time. So the Mechilta clearly links the process of Korban Pesach in Mitzrayim to the dam of Bris Milah. In at least one source, this link goes one step further. If you turn, and this one is a little bit of a graphic medrash, but I decided I would share it with you anyway. Just because it's so powerful and so unique. Medrash says as follows in source number 10, which is Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Do you only have one side? You only have one side. That's my master. Okay, now we've found the other half of the master. Okay, good. Bnei Yaakov malu et bnehem, ved bnei bnehem. Yaakov's children, when they went down to Mitzrayim, remember that there was one mitzvah given to Bnei Yisrael in Sefer Bereshit, essentially, namely Brit Milah. It's the only mitzvah technically given to Avraham and Avraham's children, at least in the text of the Chumash. Or Sefer Bereshit. So that becomes their identity, that becomes the essentially the tradition of the Jewish, of the household of Yaakov. Bnei Yaakov malu et bnei ve bnei bneihem. It's actually machloket Rishonim. It's machloket Rashi and Ramban, as to whether or not the Avot voluntarily took upon themselves all of the other mitzvot of the Torah. Rashi has an opinion, it's based on the Medrash, that the Avot kept Kol HaTorah Kula, they on their own came to all of the mitzvot of the Torah. The Ramban, in a number of places, there's all school of Rishonim who followed in the Ramban's footsteps, Rashbam and others, Ibn Ezra, who held that not so, that they had kept the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. They understood the certain moral, ethical principles that derive from the concept of ethical monotheism, which is part of the foundation of Et Elokim Italech Noach, to walk with God, and Bris Milah, which was the only explicit mitzvah given to Bnei, to Avraham and his children. So it's interesting, Machlok Rishonim, not for our discussion here, but you should be aware of it. Bnei Yaakov malu et bnehem ve et bnei bnehem ve in chilam lechok olam, they transferred or they transmitted this principle of Bris Milah as a rule, as a law for generations to come. Ad she'amad paro harasha v'gazar gzerot kashot, until paro came along and implemented various decrees. Umana lehem brit milah. You can have both sheets. I don't need it. I have it on the computer. Umana lehem brit milah. And one of those decrees, says the Medrash, was Paro forbade the Jewish people from performing brit milah. Whether that historically is how it came about or not, I'm not sure. But certainly there's a question whether this Medrash is somewhat anachronistic, because we know that during the Greek period of time they forbade circumcision. Whether the Medrash is anachronistically applying that back to the time of Paro in Mitzrayim. But for whatever reasons, the Medrash is looking for the reason why when they left Egypt, when they went down to Egypt, they were circumcised. When they left Egypt, they were not. So it was either because it was imposed upon them from the outside, or it was part of that process of self-imposed assimilation, which is the other line of thought in the Medrash. When they left Egypt, nimolu kol ha'am mikaton ve'ad gadol. At that point, they circumcised themselves, small to from young to old, the entire generation circumcised. As it says, Kimulim Hayu. The Pasuk Kimulim Hayu is a Pasuk in Yehoshua. It's a Pasuk in our Perek. If you recall, we're studying Sefer Yehoshua. I know that it sometimes feels that we're studying all kinds of other things. But and there it says that the reason why they had to circumcise the generation that entered into the Israel is because the generation that left Egypt was circumcised. The generation in the Midbar was not. Kimulim Hayu Yisrael. V'ayu Yisrael. Look, now listen to this. V'ayu Yisrael lokhin dam brit milah. Notnin al mashkof batehem dam brit milah v'dam pesach. Medrash says that when they put the blood on the doorposts, it was a combination of the blood of the Bris Milah and the blood of Korban Pesach. It's the only source I found for that notion, that the dam on the Mashkof was actually a combination of the required dam of Korban Pesach with the dam of Bris Milah, to link these two mitzvot together. V'nitmale rachamim ha'Yisrael. And that's when, and that's what brought about the Ribbono Shel Olam's compassion over Israel, as it says, it doesn't say in your blood, but in your bloods, in the plural, b'shnei damim, dam brit milah v'dam pesach, a combination of the two mitzvot. Rabbi Eliezer omer v'chimah ra'ah, katuv shnei pa'amim b'damayich chayi. Why did the Navi say b'damayich chayi twice? Al America Shbach Bishut Dam Bila Ubishut Dam Pesach Nikalum Mitzrayim. The merit of Dam Pesach and the merit of Dam Mila together brought us out, allowed us to leave Egypt. Ubishut Dam Brit Mila Ubishut Dam Pesach Atem Atidim Higael Besof Machut Vi. And Latid Lavo, the two mitzvot that will enable us to leave the final exile and be worthy of the redemption are the same two mitzvot, Pesach and Mila. I will not get into a discussion here, but you can use your imagination of the implications of suggesting that the two mitzvot that will remain steadfast and held till the end and will enable us to leave the redemption, to leave the exile, are Mila and Pesach. There's a whole sociological phenomenon associated with the fact that with all of the assimilation through the ages, that the two most practiced rituals in Jewish life today are Mila and Pesach. That's a whole different discussion. So there you have it. That's clearly, I think that's the strongest reference that I've found in the Midrashic sources for a fundamental link between Pesach and Mila. So I want to go back to the question that I raised at the end of the shiur last week. I understand Pesach. If we look at Pesach as a symbol of the loyalty to God against the backdrop of the idolatry of Egypt. I show the Medrash that says, Mishchu Kulachem, you had to draw away and take. What does a draw away and take mean? So the Medrash says, Mishchu Yedechem Yavarazah, Kulachem Yisalavet Abot Salamayit. You had to draw away from the idolatry of Egypt before you could engage in the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach was a symbolic, not so symbolic, break from the idolatrous culture of Egypt. It was a statement. It was a, you put your life in your hands and you claimed your loyalty, you staked your loyalty to God against your loyalty to Pharaoh and Egyptian culture. And from that point forward, the Korban Pesach became symbolic with that kind of national brit, a covenant with God. And historically, every time we engaged in that covenant or renewed that covenant, we did so through the Korban Pesach. Bris Milah, in a certain sense, has the same connotation. Bris Milah, on a personal scale, not on a national scale, but on a personal scale, is also a brit. It's also a covenant. Its symbolism is not... the meaning of Bris Milah is multiple levels of understanding of what the purpose of Bris Milah is all about. But one of them links directly to the notion of the Korban Pesach as a brit. Specific, and I think we addressed this a little bit when we studied the story of Yehoshua's name. Remember back to the beginning of the year, we talked about the renaming of Yehoshua. We had a discussion about when Yehoshua was renamed. Remember? And we suggested that Yehoshua, even though it's mentioned in the context of Chet HaMeraglim, the Rambam Mefarshim would say that the renaming of Yehoshua was done much earlier as a symbol of loyalty, as a disciple to his master. It's interesting that the renaming of Avraham accompanies Bris Milah, as if to say that there's some kind of demonstration of loyalty to one's master that is recognized sociologically through the name renaming that is connected somehow to Bris Milah. So one explanation, and I don't know if I mentioned this then, but I'll suggest it here, one explanation is that there's a theory in Tamei HaMitzvot, there's a whole school of analysis of mitzvot, philosophical understanding of mitzvot. It's machloket in the Gemara, actually, whether or not we're allowed to engage in an attempt to try to understand the mitzvot or not. But most Rishonim, certainly Paskin, like Reb Shimon, who says that we are allowed to engage in at least an attempt to understand the mitzvot as best we can. Not always can we, and with certain caveats and certain limitations. But there is a school of thought within the field of philosophy, Jewish philosophy, that is essentially the approach of the Rambam, that says that mitzvot have multiple levels of meaning. And that the first level of meaning is the historical one, meaning that the Torah wasn't given in a vacuum. In contradistinction, perhaps, to the assertion that Kadmat Torah Le'olam, that the mitzvot of the Torah are independent of any historical context because they predate the world, the Rambam has a philosophy that says that there is the first level of understanding of a mitzvah can often be its historical context. What does the mitzvah mean in the generation to which it was given, or in the context, historical milieu in which it was ascribed? Classic example that the Rambam uses for this is Korbanot, where the Rambam claims that the entire institution of Korbanot was in a sense a way of trying to wean us off the pagan ritual practices of the generations prior by limiting Korbanot to one place, to one God, to one focus. It's a machloket Rambam and the Ramban as to whether or not the Mikdash was a bedieved or a lechatchila. Very famous and very somewhat controversial machloket, but nonetheless. The Rambam himself goes out of his way to say that that doesn't mean that the mitzvot are time-limited historically. The same Rambam who says that the purpose of Korbanot was to wean us off from pagan rituals is the same Rambam who writes explicitly in the Mishnah Torah that Latid Lavon, when the Mashiach comes and the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, we will all go back to bringing Korbanot, because Korbanot, not a single mitzvah, will be abrogated from the Torah. So there's a certain contradiction there, the resolution of which is essentially the notion that mitzvot can mean different things in different generations, but the first level of interpretation is always, or can be often, its historical context and meaning. In that context, Bris Milah may have a unique interpretation. You know, there's a... I'll give another example, and it'll be easier to understand Bris Milah this way.
You mean historically?
Historically.
Would it be unique?
Yeah, what would be the meaning of the mitzvah of Bris Milah in its historical context? So let me back up one step. You know, there's a mitzvah... There's a concept called Eved Ivri, which is a Jewish slave or Hebrew slave. A Jewish slave is to be set free after 6 years. Actually, let's start one step further, one step back. Let's start with an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani, a Gentile slave, who the Torah says in Parshat Mishpatim, if you harm a slave, if you take out the slave's eye or a slave's tooth, Shein V'ayin, you set the slave free. So, at a simple level, it's a halacha. It simply states that you have to treat a person as a person, and that even those who are servants or what the Torah calls an eved are human beings and have to be treated as such. However, there is a very powerful historical context to that mitzvah, because we know from historical sources, we know from the tablets of the laws of Hammurabi, that in the milieu on the time, you know who Hammurabi was? He was the king of Mesopotamia in the time of Avraham Avinu. And he was the first king to establish set of rules and laws. They almost read like Parshas Mishpatim. It's interesting. You can look at them historically. We have documentation of them, and they read in style very similar to Parshas Mishpatim. It's very interesting, with fundamental differences. And one of the fundamental differences is that in Chukei Hammurabi it says that if a slave runs away, and you catch them, you must brand them by taking out their tooth or eye to demonstrate that they may not run away. So what did the Torah do? In a certain sense, the Torah took laws that were familiar to us in context and put them into an ethical context that would fit the Torah's value system. Another example, the notion of an Eved Ivri. An Eved Ivri has to be set free after 6 years. What if an Eved Ivri decides he wants to stay permanently as an Eved? So the Torah says you have to, it's called Ritzuata Ozen. Like you would take the Vretzad and Avat Ozno. You would take the slave, take him over to the door, and essentially you pierce the ear. That's essentially what it is. It's a complicated pasuk, but essentially it means you pierce the ear. Okay. So Rashi says it means to tell me that the Torah says that the slave goes free after 6 years, and the ozen, the ear that heard on Mount Sinai, avadayhem v'lo avadim l'avadim, that they are my servants and not servants to human beings, should not really have wanted to stay as a slave forever. Nonetheless, we allowed it so he has to pierce the ear. On the other hand, we know historically, and I can show you from Tanakh sources, that it was standard practice in the time of Tanakh that a king would demonstrate or would hold on to the loyalty of his servants and his slaves by branding them. So, for example, we know at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, there's a Canaanite king by the name of Adoni Bezek. Adoni Bezek says, Shivim melachim behonot yidehem v'raglehem kutzatzim hayu melaktim tachat shulchani. Adoni Bezek makes a declaration and a sort of a boast that there are 70 thumbs and big toes of kings that are sitting in a box under his kitchen table. Shivim melachim behonot yidehem v'raglehem mekutzatzim hayu melaktim tachat shulchani. Meaning, every time he waged war, and every time he was victorious over a kingdom, he demonstrated the subjugation of that kingdom by maiming the king, by taking off the king's thumb or toe and collecting them. These were his trophies. That was Canaanite. And it's not just Adoni Bezek. I'll give you another powerful example. I know it's in between breakfast and lunch, but you'll bear with me.
It wouldn't matter what time of the day it was.
You'll bear with me. In Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph. In certain parts of the world. Vaya'al Nachash Amoni. Nachash, king of Ammon, comes against the people of Yavesh Gilad, Israelite community on the east side of the Jordan. Vayamu, and surrounds it, about to conquer it, about to take it, destroy it. Vayamu kol anshei Yavesh al Gilad, kol anshei Yavesh al Nachash. So the people of Yavesh want to surrender. So they turned to Nachash and they said, if you want to follow him, Perek Yud Aleph of Shmuel Aleph, it's two psukim. Vaya'al Nachash Amoni, Vayichan al Yavesh Gilad. Nachash attacks Yavesh Gilad. Vayamu kol anshei Yavesh al Nachash. Krot lanu brit vin avdeka. Make a covenant with us, make a pact, and we'll serve you. That's a biblical way of saying, in modern terms, state your terms. We surrender. State your terms. Make a brit, and we will serve you. So Nachash says, fine, here are my terms. Vayomer alehem Nachash ha'amuni. This is the king of the Ammonites. Ammon Moab. Bizot echlot lechem. You want a brit? I'll be happy to comply. Bin kor lechem kol ha'ayin yamin. Everybody sends me their right eye. Simple. V'samtiach kerpa al kol Yisrael. And I'll make it an abomination against Israel. That is that's standard practice. Comes along the Torah and says, first of all, an eved, you're not allowed a maim. And second of all, even if an eved wants to become an eved le'olam, the most you can do essentially to mark that person as an eved is to pierce the ear. In other words, the Torah takes what essentially was standard practice, which is inherently immoral and unethical, and reframes it in an ethical context. Now, does that have application to Bris Mila? Possibly. Why? If we look at the concept of Avdei HaMelech, if we look at the concept of what it means to be the servant of the king, in the biblical arena, what is the name given to the servants of kings? It's a title given consistently to the servants of kings. From Sefer Breshit to Megillat Esther. From one end of Tanakh to the other. Servants of kings are known as... Say it louder.
Sarisim.
Potiphar, Sris, Paro. Vayiktsof Paro al Shnei Sarisav. And in Megillat Esther, you have the constant reference to Hegai Sris HaMelech, Shomer HaPilagshim, etc. Standard practice in the biblical arena, if you became the servant of the king, you were castrated again.
So
why?
Potiphar was castrated?
Right.
No wonder his wife was.
No, not Potiphar, his servants. His servants, those who were the keepers, for a simple reason, those who were the keepers, those who were the keepers of his harem. Hegai Sris HaMelech Shomer HaNashim. Right, those who were the keepers of the king's harem. King didn't, the king trusted you with the harem, but only so much. So when the Torah comes along to Avram and it says, you are now to become my servant, in the context of understanding that the Rabbanu Shalom is Melech Machay Melechim, in the context, you can't, it would be unethical, it would be unheard of, it would be completely absurd to talk about the castration of an entire nation, although there have been religious systems that have insisted on essentially a social form of the same effect, which is celibacy. The Torah, A, does not expect that, does not want that. The very promise to Abraham was a promise of seed. But at the same time, the notion of demonstrating a loyalty to God was, and a loyalty to God as the king, and the recognition of Israel as God's servants, avadayim v'lo avadim l'avadim, may be a deeper meaning of the mitzvah of Bris Milah. To take that which was an ancient practice, in its harshest sense, and reformulate it into an ethical context which is ethical, moral, and has a certain, maybe even medical benefit. I'm not going to get into that discussion, but certainly has a symbolic gesture, indicates that we are essentially the servants of God through a form of physical identification of the tribe as a whole. So that creates, that gives a deeper meaning to the concept of Bris Milah and why Bris Milah was essentially the prerequisite for Korban Pesach. Bris Milah was essentially the personal brit that demonstrated loyalty to God, our King, we are his servants, Avadai Heim Asher Tzeitu Tamerit Mitzrayim. Bris Milah gave Korban Pesach gave the spiritual dimension of the abandonment of idolatry and the recognition of the covenant with God. So the two of these two britot essentially connect in a way that formulates them as the symbols of the brit. Personal brit, national brit. Hence a prospective convert goes through the personal brit at the time of the conversion, and the Gemara says, "Ahava mina," that they should even bring Korban Pesach immediately. And the Gemara says, "No, they can't bring the Korban Pesach without Pesach, so they have to wait until Pesach time, and then they bring a Korban Pesach together with the rest of Klal Yisrael. That Pesach for them serves as part of the conversion process because it brings them into the brit on multiple levels: the personal brit of Bris Milah, the national brit of idolatry of Brit Pesach."
So how does that go along with women?
So, you know, that the answer to that question is on two levels. I'll answer that question on two levels. Number one, we'll get to part two of the shiur today in a moment, and you'll see a second answer. Number one, when we talk about a brit on a national scale, the brit milah of the people becomes identified as a brit for the entire generation, for the entire people. For example, when the Torah talks about Shimshon going down to the Philistines and taking a Philistine, falling in love with a Philistine woman, so Navi says that Shimshon's parents, in their initial response to his choice of partner, says, I love this pasuk, it's a powerful, powerful pasuk. Pasuk says, Din Shoftim Perek Yudalid. Beginning of Perek Yudalid. Pasuk Gimel. Vayomer lo avich, vayomer lo aviv imo. His father and mother said to him, Ha'en bifnot achecha ubechol ami isha. Is there not one woman amongst all of your brethren, amongst all of my people? That you go and take a wife from these, or choose a wife from these uncircumcised Philistines? So first of all, the emotional reaction of the parents is interesting. But second of all, the reference, we're talking about the woman, we're talking about the woman he falls in love with, to refer to the plishtim as arelim, uncircumcised, in reference to the woman is irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. Only that it's relevant in the sense, it's actually in a sense, a segue into the second part of this, it's relevant because a people that is uncircumcised amongst the males means that the generation of the entire nation is uncircumcised. The mitzvah is performed by the males. The brit is achieved by the generation. It's the marriage unit that is essentially identified through the mitzvah of Bris Milah. So it's not a notion that the man is circumcised and therefore the man enters the brit. The man is circumcised and the family or the people, the community, the nation enters into the brit of Bris Milah.
And it's the mother that gives her child in 8 days.
This is a very important point. That the brit, it's a personal mitzvah, but it's a national brit. And the brit is related specifically to, on the one hand, we talked before about this notion of it being symbolic of the brand of loyalty to God. In that sense, the male carries the brand. God wasn't going to brand the women. I understand that. But there's also a second level to it, in the fact that it creates a certain purity in the marriage process. It creates a certain limitation on who you marry. In which with the mitzvah of Brit Milah, it became, even before the prohibition of intermarriage, there was an intuitive sociological understanding that it would limit the interaction between one group and another. That's the story of Yaakov and Shechem. where they come to Shechem. This is before Matan Torah, before you have halachic definition of who's Jewish and who's not Jewish. The only definition that you have is essentially bris milah. So they come to the people of Shechem, and the people of Shechem want to marry. So they said, we won't marry your daughters or your sons until you circumcise your males. What happened to it? How does the circumcise of the males allow you to marry the daughters? Right? But it's the same principle. That the generation as a whole becomes engaged in the brit, even if the mitzvah is performed only by the male population. And it becomes symbolic of what in the terminology of Jewish philosophers is called Torah Hazera, the purity of the seed of Israel. The notion that we marry only within the Jewish people, that it limits the concept of intermarriage between one person and another, and the intermarriage carries with it a sociological drama of the cross-pollinization of cultures. So intermarriage per se has two issues related to it. Number one, it has an element of, if in and of itself it is forbidden, in and of itself it creates is an act of rebellion against the Jewish people, it's an act of rebellion against the Torah. By and of itself it's wrong. But it has a broader context. And the broader context is that when you take a generation and you engage them in a cultural interaction with a outside population, you create not only a brit of marriage, but the potential for a brit of interaction, for an interaction over cultures and idolatry, and a sharing of values, and then suddenly you're into idolatry. So it's interesting, when you look at intermarriage in the Torah, that's right, when you look at intermarriage in the Torah, intermarriage is always connected to idolatry. There's nowhere in the Chumash where intermarriage is identified by itself as prohibited. It's always a prelude to idolatry. I'll show you a couple of examples. Very interesting context. Take a look, for example, in Shmot Perek Lamed Dalet. Starting with Pasuk Yud. God says, I will make a brit with you before all of the nations of Israel. Before all of the nations of the land I will do great wonders. Wonders that are unmatched and unparalleled. All the nations in whose midst you will be will see that all of the great wonders that God will do, God is with you, God is great. Watch yourselves, guard yourselves, be careful against all for everything I command you today. I will expel all of the nations before you. Make sure that you do not engage in any kind of covenantal contract relationship or brit with the local indigenous population. Lest they become a stumbling block before you. You have to destroy their altars, you have to destroy their high places, you have to burn their trees. What kind of interaction are we talking about? Mizbeach, Matzevah, and Asherah. Idolatrous ones, right? Lest you end up bowing to a foreign god. Ki Hashem kanoshmo. Kel kanahu. God is zealous. Don't anger God. Now look at the next pasuk. Pen tichrot brit li yosheva aretz. Lest you make a covenant with the local inhabitants. Vizanu acharei Elohim. and go after their gods, v'zavchu l'Elohim, and bring sacrifices to the gods, v'kara lecha v'achalta mizivcho, they'll call you and ask you to join their barbecue. Come and have a barbecue with me. V'lakachta mibnotav levanecha, and you'll take of their daughters for your sons. V'zanu bnotav acharei Elohim, and their daughters will lead you after their gods. V'iznu et banecha acharei Elohim, and they will lead your sons after their gods. There's an identification, a clear connection between the notion of intermarriage on a national scale, on a communal scale, and the cultural interaction which leads to idolatry. They'll marry you, and then they'll lead you over to the theological implications of their background. This notion of a link between bris, between intermarriage and idolatry is a link that carries through all of Chumash. It's a constant refrain. And actually, it goes back to it may be, I'm sure it is, the reason why Avram is told, or Avraham tells Eliezer not to take a wife for Yitzchak from the daughters of Canaan, but to go back to his home in Haran, because Canaan was essentially pagan in its core, idolatrous in its core. This is pre-Matan Torah, so there's no halachic definition of intermarriage, but there is a cultural understanding that Avraham is engaged in a new philosophical, theological relationship with God. The pagan world of Canaan can't understand that. So to find a wife, he goes back to his home community, where there's a language, there's a cultural identification with where he's coming from. And it may explain...
So it's the culture he identifies with, not the fact that they're pagan also.
Well, in Haran, they're less pagan. In other words, Haran, it's a whole other context to why Canaan idolatry is particularly offensive. It's a different kind of idolatry. I think we talked about that a little bit at the beginning of the year. Canaanite idolatry was a flavor that was particularly offensive. It was child sacrifice, it was virgin rape, it was all kinds of immoral behaviors that went with it, whereas in other idolatrous cultures, even contemporary ones, you didn't have that moral overtone to it. But it may also be an explanation for why there's a link between Mila and Pesach. Because Mila, which represents the limitation of marriage to within ourselves, represents a certain notion that we only marry other circumcised families, referring to both male and female, not female circumcision, God forbid, but the cultural affiliation of a generation that links itself to this notion of Brit Milah, as in the story of Shechem, and Pesach, which represents the notion of the abandonment of idolatry. These two are connected.
Isn't it halacha to שאוסרת נישואי תערובת? או, this is like until עזרא ונחמיה. עזרא ונחמיה
is... What is your question?
Is it from the Torah and start of the Yosef? שאוסרת בעצם נישואי תערובת?
Yes, it's a biblical prohibition. Intermarriage is a biblical prohibition, but the Torah couches it in a lo titchaten bam. So, biblical prohibition of lo titchaten bam, specifically in the context of the seven nations of Canaan. So the Chazal understood it to mean that intermarriage is prohibited with everybody. But why does the Torah explicitly identify intermarriage as prohibited with the nations of Canaan? For this reason, because there's a constant link between intermarriage and idolatry. The same reference to the seven nations of Canaan as the indigenous Canaanite pagan population to which we have to remove from the land because we can't allow a idolatry to run free in this land. It has to create an idolatry-free zone. We spoke about that at the beginning of the year. It's that same prohibition that says you can't marry them, you can't make a brit with them, you can't engage with them for cultural reasons, cultural in the religious sense of the term. Meaning because of the possibility of the cultural influence in idolatry. That doesn't mean that there isn't a prohibition against intermarriage beyond that. There certainly is. But it's an extrapolation of the Torah's intent. The explicit reference is always in the context of the seven nations of Canaan and in the context of one leading to the other. So you have essentially bris milah, which is your symbol of your prohibition of intermarriage, linked to Dam Pesach, or to Korban Pesach, which is a symbol of the abandonment of idolatry, or the negation of idolatry. That's essentially what's going on. You have two prohibitions in the Torah that are connected, intermarriage and idolatry, and two britot in the Torah that are designed to protect against those two violations. Bris Milah on the one hand, and Korban Pesach on the other. That's the parallel. That the Milah-Pesach relationship correlates to the intermarriage-idolatry relationship when it comes to the nations of Canaan. I'll go one step further. This dual Brit, which essentially is reflected in Milah and Pesach, actually goes all the way back to the promise to Abraham over the land of Israel. Because there are two Britot with Abraham over the land. God promises Abraham the land twice. One is Brit Ben Abtarim, which is all about the animals. You take the animals and you split them. It's all about Korbanot. Take the animals, divide them apart, walk in between, and God promises in the land of Israel. It's the culmination of that, right? For 400 years you'll be slaves, and afterwards you'll come back to this land 4 generations later. All of that's Brit Ben Abtarim. And then one parak later you have Brit Milah. And Brit Milah, the Brit, the covenant of circumcision in Sefer Breshit, is also a covenant over the land. It's also a promise of the land of Israel. In Perek Yud Zayin, Akimoti Briti Beinu Uveinecha Uvein Zeracha Acharecha LeDoratam LeBrit Olam, will make this covenant between me and your seed after you for generations to come. Liot Lecha LeLoim LeZeracha Acharecha, to be your God for generations. VeNatati Lecha LeZeracha Acharecha Eretz Megurecha Kol Eretz Kanan Achuzat Olam, and I will give you the land of Israel as a land of Canaan, as an inheritance for generations to come. There's two britot, Brit Milah and Brit Pesach. There's two britot over the land of Israel, Brit Ben Abtarim and Brit Milah. And there's two fundamental issues related to the nations of Canaan, the Brit of marriage and the Brit of idolatry. It's a link between them. It's a theme that runs through. And if you take it one step further, you could even identify this as the story of Pinchas. Pinchas, what happens with Pinchas? Pinchas, they get to Shittim. Remember where Shittim is? Shittim is the story. Remember the story of Pinchas? Where Cosby Batsur, the sea of Shevet Shimon, goes and he takes a Moabite Midianite woman in the front of the tent of Moshe. Pinchas sees what's going on, then he takes a spear and he gives them both a bris milah. What's going on? The intermarriage of that moment is essentially a claim by Shevet Shimon that we're here, we're in our land, and we can take the local population as wives. And Pinchas is appalled by it. He says, how could you do that? There's even a medrash that says that the rationale behind it was exactly the rationale or the mistake that you mentioned before. Midianite, Moabite, they're not part of the seven nations of Canaan. The Torah prohibits intermarriage with the seven nations of Canaan. This is Ephraim Hayarden, the other side of the Jordan. This is Moabite, this is Canaanite, this is the Midianite. This has nothing to do with it. It's permissible. And they come to Moshe and they ask Moshe, "Nu, what's going on? What's the halacha? Bo'al Aramit." And Moshe doesn't know what to do. Torah says seven nations of Canaan. This is not one of the seven nations of Canaan. So what do I do with this? Till Pinchas takes a spear and he says, This is impossible. Everything, every fiber of his being says to him, from Brit Milah of Avram Avinu, to the Brit of Milah connected to Pesach, to the prohibition of intermarriage because it leads to idolatry. Everything he has been told and taught and understood means this is wrong. If you can't find the technical halachic linchpin over which to put it, that doesn't make a difference. It's immoral and it's intolerable. So he takes a spear and he kills them both. And the result is, we know the story of Pinchas. Chazal linked Pinchas to another personality in Tanakh. Eliyahu. Right? Eliyahu fought his whole life against two things. His whole life. You know the story of Eliyahu? Right? Eliyahu, Har Carmel, Nevi'ei HaBaal, idolatry of Baal. Eliyahu fought his whole life against the idolatry of Baal. By the way, the idolatry of Baal has a certain sexual connotation to it because it involved virgin
fertility
and everything else. By the way, Eliyahu's whole campaign was against Ahab and against his idolatry of reintroducing the idolatry of Baal into the land of Israel. But there's a second campaign Eliyahu waged, and that was a campaign against, not against Ahab, but against
what?
Who was the instigator of the idolatry in the household of Ahab? Who started it?
Izebel.
Right? Ahab's first act as king is to marry Izebel. Izebel is the daughter of Etbaal, king of Sidon. We discuss this at all?
Thank you, Mark.
Names are very significant in Tanakh. Etbaal is Ish Baal. Izebel is Baal, or Eshet Baal. Uh-huh. She is the daughter of the king of Sidon, who is an idolatrous king. He marries her because it's a political marriage. The first thing she does is she introduces Baal back into the land of Israel, an idolatry that hasn't existed in the land of Israel since the days of Shmuel and Navi. Give me 30 seconds, because I want to leave you with a punchline that'll just that'll blow you away. The campaign of Eliyahu's whole life was against the marriage of Ahab to Izebel. Izebel is the source of all evil in the second half of Malchut Yisrael. Right? From Izebel to the whole story of Izebel is unbelievable. Izebel wants to kill him, he has to run away. His whole life is a campaign against against Baal and against Izebel. Against the intermarriage and the adultery. That which is symbolized by the opposite of Bris Milah and the opposite of Korban Pesach. Correct? Okay. In Jewish ritual, Eliyahu is the only Navi that doesn't die. Goes up to Shemayim. And for generations to come, Eliyahu in the ritual of Jewish life appears twice every year. Or twice in total. Pesach and Bris Milah. Now, do you know why Eliyahu comes to every bris? You know why Eliyahu? There's no, by the way, there's no technical halachic source for the notion of Eliyahu at the Seder. The only halachic source that we open the door and say Shvach HaMoscha. It doesn't say necessarily we open the door for Eliyahu. That's the understanding of it, is that Eliyahu comes to drink the kos. But we do have a halachic source for the notion of Eliyahu coming to every bris. And the reason for it is actually counterintuitive.
That's
most people think, most people think it's because, right? Symbol of bris. Eliyahu comes to every bris, says the Medrash, and you have it in Source 11. I'll just tell you the upshot of it, because Eliyahu ends his life when he says to God, "Kanoki niti Hashem Elokei Yisrael, a Yisrael asher ezvud britecha asher ezvud britecha mizbuchatecha harasu vet neviecha argu bacharev vayvater ani levadi." Eliyahu says, "I was zealous for you, O God, because Israel has abandoned your brit and destroyed your altars and murdered or executed all the Nevi'im." All of that's, by the way, the work of Izebel. So the Medrash says, Source 11 is an old story about Bris Milah and how they abandoned Bris Milah at the time of Ahab and Izebel. Same basic idea to the story of Mitzrayim. And then Eliyahu says, "Kanoki neti, I was zealous for you, O God." God says to him, in the second half of this medrash, "Amar lo liolamata mekane, you're always going to be zealous. Kineta b'shitim agili arayot, you were zealous back in Shittim for adultery. Shenema Pinchas ben Elazar, here you're zealous. Chayecha she'en osin brit mila ad she'atar ro'eh b'enecha. On your life," God says to Eliyahu, "for eternity, No Jew will ever perform bris milah until you come to testify, until you come and prove with your own eyes that Israel never abandoned the brit. As a tikkun for the accusation against Israel, his accusation was against Izebel, his accusation was against Ahav, but Eliyahu, whose entire life stood for din and kanos and zealousness, turned that accusation against the people. God says to him, for the rest of eternity, you will attend every bris to demonstrate and testify before God to the loyalty that Israel has shown to the mitzvah of bris milah, and by extension, I think that's why we invite him to every Seder. Because the Medrash said that the redemption of Israel will take place because of the loyalty of the Jewish people to the mitzvah of bris milah and to the mitzvah of Pesach. And Eliyahu, who is the harbinger of the redemption, who will be the one who will usher in the Mashiach, the Eliyahu will do so because he'll be able to testify to the Rabbanu Shlom that through generations to come, Israel stood loyal to the two britot of Dam Milah and Dam Pesach, which we had in Mitzrayim, we had when we entered the land of Israel, and Eliyahu will prove that we have again when we come back to Eretz Yisrael.